Hello and welcome to the One Sealed Letter podcast. I'm Kay Collier, the voice and warm body behind this podcast, and Catherine Hastings and Company, our sponsor. My mission is to have the world write more beautiful letters. And this podcast, One Sealed Letter, is all about how to take that legacy of letter writing, taking things that we can learn from history, looking at historic letters, looking at the human experience to better understand ourselves, but also to understand how the rich soul and tradition of letter writing can still apply today. There are so many unique things that I notice about the time that we live in and how the legacy of letter writing fits the needs of this time so well. Obviously, it's a time where we don't necessarily need physical mail to get information from point A to point B. But in my opinion, writing letters hasn't just been about the exchange of information. It's really about the exchange of our time, our energy, our creativity. Lord Byron's biographer said that letter writing is the perfect combination of company and solitude. And I find in the time where we live, where things are so fast-paced, and also there's so many different things that are vying for our attention, that to take time just to step back and write a letter, it gives us something, and it gives the person that we're sending the letter to something as well, because they have that slow experience of reading the letter. And particularly for beautiful letters, so my mission is about beautiful letters, it has the heartfelt piece, but then there's also care that's taken to the physical details of the letter, be it a wax seal, be it a drawing, be it the handwriting. There's something tangible in the beauty, but then there's also a real soulfulness to the letters. I mentioned that our moment in time is unique for letter writing, but obviously it's not the only time in history that has had unique aspects that make it perfect for letter writing. In today's episode, we're looking at the letters between Emperor Nicholas II and his wife, Alexandra, the last czar and czarina of the Romanov Empire. Their time was unique, obviously, in many ways, with the tumult of the era, with changes happening in Russia, the death of a 300-year-old dynasty at the end of their lives, but also World War I, changes in the way that different regions of the world were understanding economy and how society was going through a huge transformation. In this episode, I won't get too much into all of the history because it's really too much to cover in just one podcast episode, but I wanted to first just provide a little bit of context about where we find ourselves with these two individuals. And then as we go through, I've picked just a few letters and diary entries to choose from. But first, I think it's really important to note the unique time that they lived in. The Emperor Nicholas II was the son of Emperor Alexander III, whose father was Emperor Alexander II. Alexander II, so Nicholas's grandfather, I'll call him Nicholas, I'll call him Nicky in this episode just to make it easy. Nicky's grandfather, Alexander II, did a lot of things to, in a way, kind of liberalize Russia. He freed the serfs. He had some other reforms, making it more of a, I wouldn't necessarily say fully democratic society, but kind of moving towards that. And he was violently assassinated. And so his son, Emperor Alexander II, and his grandson, Nicky, definitely saw kind of a reaction to, okay, well, if you go too liberal with your politics, it could be very dangerous. And we see in the story of the Romanovs, how it ended for them. Not to say that it was them being too liberal. In fact, it's probably kind of the opposite, and an inability to show care for the Russian people. But all that to say that Russia was going through a major transformation during Nicky's lifetime and before. Alexandra is the granddaughter of Queen Victoria. Alexandra, who we'll call Alex in this episode, Alix was how Nikki addressed her, is, so Alix is the daughter of Alice, who is the daughter of Queen Victoria, or was the daughter of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. Alix's mother, Alice, died when Alix was quite young. She was maybe about 5 or 6 years old when her mother died, and she had already lost a brother before that, and then when her mother died, another one of her siblings died as well. So she had a pretty tragic childhood early on, but because she had lost her mother, she actually lived with her grandmother. Now, Alix is German, but her grandmother, Queen Victoria, obviously the head of the English monarchy, was English, and so Alix was brought up under Queen Victoria and really was educated as a Victorian woman. And again, I won't talk too much about the history, but that is an important thing to note. There are challenges in Alix's life because at sometimes she's seen as too German. So for instance, in World War I, when Russia was fighting Germany, it was very difficult for the Tsar's wife to be German because the people were distrusting her and they were distrusting him, fearing that she was a spy or that the court was too closely tied to Germany. Other times, Alix was seen as too English because of her upbringing under Queen Victoria. She followed the societal norms of English society at that time. And that meant that she often had kind of a coldness to her, that stereotype that we even have today of British having a stiff upper lip. She was very much kind of sophisticated and somewhat with emotionally withheld or kind of cold English woman, as was seen by people in the court in Russia. She was very serious, which wasn't normal for their culture. And so again, at sometimes she was seen as too English, and at sometimes she was seen as too German. It's worth noting that both Alix and Nicholas were directly tied to the English throne. Alix's grandmother was Queen Victoria, while Nikki's grandparents were King Christian the Ninth of Denmark and Louise of Hesse-Cassel. Their daughter, Alexandra, married Edward the Seventh. So Edward the Seventh was Victoria's son, and they had George the Fifth. So I know that's a little bit convoluted, but basically, Alix and Nikki were both cousins with George V, who was on the throne of England at the time. So both came from these strong aristocratic backgrounds, tied with connections deeply tied to England. On Alix's side, it was coming through German and English monarchy. Obviously, a lot of the English monarchy is German as well, with Albert coming from Saxe-Coburg. And then Nikki's side, ties to all different, I mean, they're all tied to multiple areas of Europe, including Greece, but his direct tie to the English throne was through his aunt, through his mom, whose sister was the mother of George V. So kind of a unique setup with their family, the way that they're tied to Europe. It was inevitable that Nikki and Alix would meet because of their ties, with both of them being not only noble, but so closely associated with the most senior monarchy of the time. I mentioned that every era has something unique for letter writing, and the era in which they lived is really unique because we have insights not just from their letters, but from their diaries. Obviously, in the time we live in now, people can write in their journal or do diary entries, but it isn't so much a part of everyday life for most people, where for the nobility of this time at least, and probably other academics and things like that, keeping a diary was quite common. And through the diary, you have an understanding of their inner life, what their day-to-day life is like, how they're seeing things, what they're excited about, what their fears are. And then through their letters, you see their connections to other people and what those relationships are like. There's a wonderful book that references Nikki and Alex's story. It's titled A Lifelong Passion, Nicholas and Alexandra, Their Own Story. Andre Mylunas and Sergey Mironenko wrote the book. It's from, I think, 1996. It doesn't have all of their letters. There were thousands, so it's not possible really to put everything in there. But it's a really great reference, and if you are wanting to dive deeper into the story, I strongly recommend picking up the book. In the introduction, Andre Mylunas mentions, quote, "So we've had, just for this short period of history, almost total access to both the outer and, much importantly, the inner world of our heroes." Also, it's important to note that because Alex was raised as a Victorian woman, English-speaking Victorian woman, that was the primary language that she spoke. Later in her life, she did learn Russian, but when she met Nikki, she didn't speak Russian, and so they communicated in English, and that continued throughout their entire lives until the very end. So also, if you're an English speaker and you want to read these letters, you're not reading translated letters. You don't need to, you know, be a scholar of Russian or anything like that, because their letters were in English anyway. A few notes also is that the podcast today, I'm going to pull from a few other documents that I have too about kind of understanding Russian history. Again, I'm not going too in depth into all of the things that happened, because covering the end of the monarchy and before that World War One, the Bolsheviks, I mean, it's just so much to cover. So I'd really like to just pull a few letters and talk about the relationship of these two unique characters. I think it's also interesting to note that the way that we see Romanovs now is often romanticized, and there's this sense of, at least for me, a world that's so mysterious and old and was just kind of savagely taken out, even just the assassination of their children in such a brutal way. But then on the other side, you have these rich palaces and, like in any European court, such opulence. And I even think about how Nikki would give Alex gifts, and they were, I think, I don't know if it was birthday or anniversary, but he would give her the special Fabergé eggs, and Fabergé would make special ones just for him, and they were these amazing pieces, some which had kind of mechanical elements to them, and they're some of the most valuable collector's items in the world, and there's actually some that are missing, which is fascinating as well. But I think even though we have this really tumultuous history and there's so much complexity to it, looking at their letters reminds me that they were just people, and clearly people that were ill-suited for the positions that they were born into, which is quite sad as well. On the notes for the letters, I'm going to use the notes that I have on the letters, but it's also worth noting that the Russian calendar was different. In February 1918, Russia changed from the old Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar, which is what we use and the rest of Europe was already using. But that is something to note. So the dates might be a little bit off of what we would actually say they are. I mentioned that Nikki and Alex would have met anyway because of the level of nobility that both of them were at. But their closeness came in part because Alex's older sister, Ella, married Nikki's uncle, Sergey. And Sergey was the younger brother of Alexander II, Nikki's father. And so obviously they would have met at other events, but because there was such closeness with her sister marrying his uncle, she actually did have more exposure to Nikki than she would have had otherwise. In 1884, they met at the wedding of his uncle and her sister. Nikki was 16 years old at the time. Alex was 12 years old. At their first meeting, we don't have letters between them, but we do have journal entries, which show their youth and kind of unique mindsets towards each other. The first excerpt I'd like to read was from Nikki's diary on the 22nd of May in 1884. In the morning, we washed the mast. We went out to church alone. Mama and Papa went to Petersburg. After a little while Aunt Marie and Uncle Pitts arrived. We then went and met Uncle Gaga's bride, the beautiful Ella, and her sisters and brother. At 7:30, the whole family dined together. I sat next to the little 12-year-old Alex, whom I really like a lot, Ella even more, her brother Ernie also. So I can just imagine a 16-year-old meeting a 12-year-old and them not necessarily even thinking themselves in the same circle, where a 12-year-old is still kind of a girl, where a 16-year-old is more of an adult. And so it doesn't indicate here that there was any love or anything like that, but just that he sat next to the 12-year-old Alex, whom he liked a lot. And there's a few more mentions in the subsequent days. Another one, though, is from the 31st of May. Just to note, the Darmstadts are Alex's family. The weather today was wonderful. We lunched, as always, with all the Darmstadts. We jumped about with them on the net. At 3:00, I went out with them in the 4-horse break. Papa drove in front of the family char bunk with Aunt Marie and Victoria. We looked at Orsaki, and everyone signed their names on the book at the mill. We drank fresh milk and ate black bread. We dined with Ernest, pretty little Alex, and Sergei. Alex and I wrote our names on the rear windows of the Italian house. We love each other. So that is just a few days from when they've met. So maybe times are a little bit different, but I thought that was kind of interesting that at first it seems kind of innocent, but then a few days later he says that he loves her. And then it talks about them playing in some of his journal entries. But then we have June 8th, and I'll just read the very last part of this diary entry from Nikki. I'm very, very sad that the Darmstadts are going tomorrow, and even more so that dearest Alex is leaving me. So that was in 1884. 5 years later, 1885, Alex, no longer 12-year-old, she's 17 years old, comes to St. Petersburg to spend winter with her sister Ella, who's now the wife of the Grand Duke Sergei. And Nikki is 20 years old, and they fall in love. After the visit, Nikki wrote Alex, and I'll read you their two short letters. May 23rd. Darling Alex, just a wee line to send you my very best wishes on your birthday, which is in 2 days. I'm now here in the Hoosiers serving with delight. I see Ella rather often, and we always speak about your stay in Petersburg. It seems to have been so long ago. I don't remember such a spring with such heats. Have you heard about the betrothal of the eldest Montenegrin with Petuchka? The Shah of Persia was too funny during his stay in Russia. God bless you, dearest Alex. One of the Pelly party, Nikki. And then Alex's reply to Nikki on June 9th. Dearest Nikki, so many thanks for your dear letter, which gave me great pleasure. It was so kind of you to remember the old tilt's birthday. Yes, it does seem like a long time since we were in Petersburg. In 1891, we have a journal entry from Nikki. And I'm just going to read an excerpt of it. But he wrote, my dream one day is to marry Alex, H, so Hesse. I have loved her for a long time, but more deeply and strongly since 1889, when she spent 6 weeks in Petersburg during the winter. For a long time, I resisted my feelings and tried to deceive myself about the impossibility of achieving my most cherished wish, But now that Eddie has withdrawn or been rejected, the only obstacle or gulf between us is the question of religion. It is the one and only barrier. I'm almost certain that our feelings are mutual. Everything is the will of God. Relying on his mercy, I resign myself to the future with equanimity. He mentions that the only gulf between them is religion. And that was a gulf. It was not a small matter between them. He, as the heir to the throne, is seen as God's representative on earth through his rule or future rule as the czar. It was believed that he was literally chosen by God to lead and be the head of the Russian Orthodox Church. Alex, raised as a Protestant, doesn't seem to fit into Russia anyway, but how can she marry the head of the Russian Orthodox Church if she's a Protestant? And you might think that the challenge is on the Russian side of they might not want her to marry, and there was definitely a lot of resistance to Alex, a lot tied to what I'd mentioned earlier of her being too English or too German. But the real challenge was Alex was Protestant, and she didn't want to give up her Protestantism in order to marry Nikki. I have a few letters that I want to highlight about this period and the challenges that Alex had trying to square her love for Nikki with her religion. She wrote to Nikki's sister, Xenia, on November 8th. "Darling Xenia, a good kiss and fondest thanks for your dear letter. It was such a pleasure hearing again from you. You do continue writing to me. Don't let what I'm going to tell you put a stop to our friendship and correspondence. My photo and a letter I have sent through Ella to Nikki. In it, he will see that I cannot change my decision. I cannot become untrue to my own confession. Do not believe that my love is less. Why, that was made it so far more hard and difficult to me, and I have been torturing myself. To hurt one whom one loves is fearful, and yet I don't want him to go on hoping, as I can never change my religion. God bless the dear, and may he think ill of his old Pelly. I feel too upset to write any more. Your old Alex. Let me hear sometimes from you, may I? Don't let us quite drift apart. That would be too hard." Alex also wrote Nikki, November 8th. And this was the letter that she'd mentioned in reference to Xenia. "Dearest Nikki, I send you my very best thanks for your dear letter and enclose the photograph you wish to have and which Ella will forward to you. I believe it must be a stronger will than ours, which ordained that we should not meet at Coburg. For like this, it gives me the chance to write to you all my innermost feelings, which perhaps on the spur of the moment I might not have said, so that you may have misunderstood me. You know what my feelings are, as Ella has told them to you already, but I feel it my duty to tell them to you myself. I thought everything for a long time, and I only beg you not to think that I take it lightly, for it grieves me terribly and makes me very unhappy. I have tried to look at it in every light that is possible, but I always return to one thing. I cannot do it against my conscience. You, dear Nikki, who have also such a strong belief, will understand me that I think it is a sin to change my belief, and I should be miserable all the days of my life, knowing that I had done a wrongful thing. I am certain that you would not wish me to change against my conviction. What happiness can come from a marriage which begins without the real blessing of God? For I feel it a sin to change that belief in which I have been brought up and which I love. I should never find my peace of mind again, and like that I should never be your real companion who should help you on in your life. For there always should be something between us two, in my not having the real conviction of belief I had taken. and in the regret for the one I had left. It would be acting a lie to you, your religion, and to God. This is my feeling of right and wrong, and one's innermost religious convictions, and one's peace of conscience toward God before all one's earthly wishes. As these years have not made it possible for me to change my resolution in acting thus, I feel that now is the moment to tell you again that I can never change my confession. I am certain that you will understand this clearly and see as I do that we are only torturing ourselves about something impossible, and it would not be a kindness to let you go on having vain hopes which will never be realized. And now, goodbye, my darling Nikki, and may God bless and protect you. Your ever loving Alex. Ever your loving Alex. We have his diary entry from November 18th. This morning, I opened the packet which had been lying on my table since last night, and in a letter from Alex from Darmstadt, I learned that everything is over between us. It is impossible for her to change religion, and all my hopes are shattered by this implacable obstacle. My best dreams and my most cherished wishes for the future, such a short time I perceived it as bright, attractive, and imminently attainable, and now it appears indifferent. Yes, it is hard sometimes to submit to the will of God. All day I went about in a daze. It's a terribly difficult to appear calm and carefree when the question affecting your whole future life is suddenly decided in this way. The weather during our walk corresponded to my state of being. It was thralling and a gale was blowing. We dined downstairs. And then we have on December 17th, a letter from Nikki to Alex. My dearest Alex, please excuse my not having answered your letter sooner, but you may well have imagined what a blow it proved to me. I could not write to tell you all the days on account of the sad state of mind I was in. Now that my restlessness has passed, I feel more calm and am able to answer your letter quietly. Let me thank you first of all the frank and open ways in which you spoke to me in that letter. There is nothing worse in the world than things misunderstood and not brought to the point. I knew from the beginning what an obstacle there rose between us, and I felt so deeply for you all these years, knowing perfectly the great difficulties you would have had to overcome. But still, it is so awfully hard when you have cherished a dream for many a year and think now you are near to it being real, it's being realized. Then suddenly the curtain is drawn and you see only an empty space and feel, oh, so lonely and so beaten down. I cannot deny the reasons that you give me, dear Alex, but I have got one which is true. You hardly know the depth of our religion. If you only could have learned it with somebody who knows it and could have read books where you might see the likeness and difference of the two, perhaps then it would not have troubled you in the same way it does now. You're living quite alone without anyone's help in such a matter is also a sad circumstance in the barrier that apparently stands between us. It is too sad for words to know that that barrier is religion. Don't you think, dearest, that the 5 years since we've known each other have passed in vain with no result? Certainly not, for me at least. And how I am to change my feelings after waiting and wishing for so long, even now, after that sad letter you sent me. I trust in God's mercy. Maybe it is His will that we both, but you especially, should suffer long, maybe after helping us through all these miseries and trials. He will yet guide my darling along the path that I daily pray for. Oh, do not say no directly, my dearest Alex. Do not ruin my life already. Do not think there can exist any happiness in the world without you. After having involuntarily kept me waiting and hoping, can this end in such a way? Oh, don't get angry with me if I am beginning to say silly things, though I promise in this letter to be calm. Your heart is too kind not to understand what tortures I am going through now. But I have spoken enough and must end this epistle of mine. Thank you so much for your charming photo. Let my wish, dearest Alex, that coming year may bring you peace, happiness, comfort, fulfillment of your wishes. God bless you and protect you. Ever your loving and devoted Nikki. Of course, we all know that she eventually does accept his proposal, but how did it happen and how did he convince her? Well, there was the wedding in Coburg that she alluded to in her letter, mentioning that I think it's best I send you a letter because I have so much time to put my thoughts together and be very clear about what I want to say, where if I were in person, I might not be able to say exactly what I want, or you might not be in the mind to interpret what I'm saying exactly how I mean it. But he did decide to go to Coburg for a wedding that they were attending. And from Coburg, he wrote his mother. So this is to Empress Marie on the 10th of April. My dearest mama, I do not know how to start this letter, as there is so much I want to say that the thoughts are all mixed up in my head. So this is how my affair turned out, thanks to the mercy of our Lord God, when I was convinced the outcome was completely hopeless. The day after our arrival here, I had a long and extremely difficult conversation with Alex, during which I tried to explain to her that she could not do otherwise than to give her consent. She was crying the whole time and only answered from time to time in a whisper, "No, I cannot." I just kept on repeating and insisting what I had already said earlier. Although this conversation went on for more than 2 hours, it ended in nothing because neither of us would give in to the other. The next morning, we talked more calmly. I gave her your letter, and after that, she said she could not say anything. This was already a sign for me of the final stage of the conflict, which had arisen within her from our first conversation. The marriage of Ernie and Ducky was the final drop in her cup of suffering and hesitations. She decided to talk to Aunt Mission. This was also Ernie's advice as he was leaving. He whispered to me that there was a hope of a happy outcome. I have to say here that during the whole of the 3 days, I suffered terrible anxiety. All of the relatives kept asking me in confidence about her and expressing their sympathy in the most touching way, wished me all the best. But all this provoked in me even greater fears and doubts that perhaps things would not be resolved. The Emperor, Wilhelm, also tried when he had a talk with Alex and on the morning of the 8th brought her to us at home. She then went to Aunt Mitchin and soon afterwards came into the room where I was sitting with the uncles, Aunt Ella, and Wilhelm. They left us alone and the first thing she said was that she agreed. Oh God, what happened to me then? I started to cry like a child and so did she. Only her expression immediately changed. Her face brightened and took on an aura of peace. No, I cannot tell you how happy I am, yet how sad that I am not with you, and that I cannot embrace you and dear Papa at this moment. My whole world has been transformed, and everything, nature, people, places, all seem attractive, good, and full of joy. I'm simply not able to write. My hands were trembling, and from then on, in fact, I did not have a single moment free. We had to do what the rest of the family were doing. There were hundreds of telegrams to be answered, and I was dying just to sit alone in the corner with my dear bride. She has completely changed and become gay, amusing, talkative, and tender. I do not know how to thank God for his great mercy. The same day we went to the service of Aunt Marie's church. She and all the sisters were present. At Alex's request, we will go to Darmstadt for one night, and now she will see her native land with quite other feelings. I had asked you if I could stay for 2 weeks, but now I think I will come earlier towards the middle of Easter week. I so want to spend a little more quality time with her. But now, my dear mama, I must finish. I'm enclosing her letter to you. I embrace dear papa and all the others. Your Nikki. I have such conflicting emotions about him because on one hand, I see him as being so devoted and loving. But then him describing the conversation in which he kept insisting they get married and she just kept saying, "No, I cannot." I just feel like that scene doesn't play great in 2024. It's worth noting that Alex was not the only love of his life. I don't know if there were others. I haven't heard anything about affairs or anything like that. But when he was a young lad, he was totally caught up on Alex, and his parents didn't think that she would be a good match. They also thought he was too inexperienced. They thought, oh, he's a little old to be a virgin, and we just need him to be more worldly and kind of grow up and become like a Russian czar, a man. And so they had him court ballerinas. The ballet was sponsored by the royal family, and I've heard it described as almost like a dating agency for their royals. And Nicholas fell in love with a ballerina called Mathilde, who they called Little Kay. And there are diary entries in which he talks about his love for Mathilde and his love for Alex, and how it's such a strange thing to have these two women whom he loves so deeply. But even in that time when he was apart from Alex and he was in love with Mathilde, it was still very clear to him that Alex was the person that he wanted to marry, and that was the person he wanted to spend his life with. And so even though his family tried to distract him somewhat from Alex and try to get him a little bit on another path, and he loved Mathilde, it was very much Alex who was always the woman for him. And I think in this letter to his mother, and we just find out kind of how sensitive he is and how distraught he is in all of this. It also reads as just really undying love that he has for her, and it was mutual as well. So again, I know the scene of her crying the whole time and him insisting they get married is a little bit hard for us to understand, but on the other side, I also see a man who's so wholly devoted to the love of his life. It's worth noting that Nikki was unprepared to become czar. His father, Alexander III, thought that he would have more time to teach his son all the things that he would need to know as emperor. His father was a strong military man. His father was quite tough, and he thought that he would have decades to be able to teach Nikki and kind of slowly teach him. Well, he ended up getting sick. He had some type of liver issue and ended up dying, I think it was at age 49. And so it was wholly unexpected. It was, I think, on November 1st or November 2nd of 1894. And immediately, Nikki, as heir to the throne, became the new emperor. He didn't have his coronation for a couple years, but he was immediately in power as emperor. I have his diary entry from November 2nd. It says, St. Petersburg. Slept well, but the moment I came to myself, the memory of what has happened and the terrible feeling of oppression invaded of my soul with renewed vigor. Poor Mama again felt unwell, and during the afternoon she fainted. At 12 o'clock, I received the full Council of State. I again had to make a speech. My dear Alex came to luncheon. It's sad to see her only at intervals. Alex, Uncle Bertie, Georgie, the Duke of York, and I dined together at 9 o'clock. She sat with me in the evening. I find it interesting that even the moment his father dies, he's talking about Alex and how he wants more time with her. That was at the very beginning of November. They needed to rush to get married because as he was emperor, he needed an empress. And so they got married, I think it was the 26th of November. His diary entry mentions, yesterday received a telegram from dear Mama saying that we can stay here one more day. My bliss is without bounds. It will be so sad to leave Tsarkoe, which has become such a dear place for us both. For the first time since our wedding, we've been able to be alone and live truly soul to soul. And then this was penned in the journal in Alex's hand. Never did I believe that there could be such utter happiness in this world, such a feeling of unity between two mortal beings. I love you. Those three words have my life in them. And then the following day, November 27th, St. Petersburg, again from his diary entry. For the last time, I strolled in the park with my darling wife. After taking tea, we left the Alexander Place and set out for Petersburg. We arrived at the Anchkov about 6 o'clock. Mama and Aunt Alex were just finishing tea. and then again in Alex's hand. No more separations, at last united, bound for life, and when this life is ended, we meet again in the other world to remain together for all eternity. Yours, yours. I feel like in the story of Nikki and Alex, there are so many omens and almost bad omens of things that happen. So her mentioning early on what good can come of a marriage if I am not honest to God myself, if I abandon my religion. Obviously, they had a lifelong love, but very tragic end. Another moment in their story that has that element of omen is the coronation. And the coronation took place a couple years after his father died and he became emperor. I'll read a couple of his diary entries here. So May 14th, this is in Moscow. A great solemn day for Alex, Mama, and myself, but one of full of moral gravity. We went on our feet from 8 o'clock in the morning, though our procession did not move off until 9:30. Luckily, the weather was heavenly. The grand staircase presented a glittering sight. Everything took place in the Uspensky Cathedral, and although it seems like a dream, I will remember it in all my life. At 9 o'clock, we went up onto the top balcony, where Alex switched on the electric illuminations on the Ivan the Great bell tower, after which all the towers and walls of the Kremlin were lit up successively. We went to bed early. With the coronation, there were multiple festivities, and not all of them were in Moscow. Obviously, they were around the empire, and there were a variety of events and appearances that they made. The bad omen that I mentioned took place on, I believe it was May 18th. We have his journal entry here. Up until now, thank God, everything went perfectly. But today, a great sin has taken place. The crowd spending the night on the Kodinka Meadow in anticipation of the distribution of the food and mugs broke through the barrier, and there was a terrible crush, during which it is terrible to say about 1,300 people were trampled. The news left an ugly impression. We lunched at 12:30, and then Alex and I went to Kodinka to present at the unfortunate popular celebration. There was nothing in particular to see. We looked out from the pavilion over the huge crowd surrounding the platform where the orchestra kept on playing the national anthem and Be Glorified. We dined with Mama at 8 o'clock, and then we went to the Montebello Ball. It was a very magnificently done, but the heat was unbearable. We left after supper at 2 o'clock. That's 2 a.m. So the event that he mentions about Kodinka really happened, obviously. There was a group of people, and some accounts say up to like 500,000 people had gathered because it was a coronation celebration, and they heard that there were going to be gifts that were given out, bread, sausage, mug that commemorated the coronation. Even just thinking about the British coronation, how there's always mugs with the emperor's faces on them. So something like that. And then it was also rumored that some of the mugs had gold coins, which I don't know if that's true or not, but that was what was circulating through the crowd. So a lot of people gathered, and then there were rumors in the crowd that there actually wasn't going to be enough for everyone. And with a crowd that large, it was out of control. And it was a shambolic event where there were people trampled. A bunch of people fell into a ditch. They were suffocated to death. And his number of 1,300 people who were trampled, that was about the death toll. And there may have been more than that. But overall, they say it was probably about 20,000 people injured, and then probably about 1,300 people who died. And so in this journal entry, he is mentioning, oh, it was a great sin that's taken place. This event, I see, is obviously a very bad omen. It's his beginning of his reign, his coronation event, this happens. Obviously, it's a coronation event that's a few days later, but still tied to the coronation. And for the public, they had a really hard time seeing the emperor as working in their favor in any way, or even caring about their plights. This event really amplified that, because that evening he went to what he called, the mentioned in the letter or his journal entry, the Montebello Ball, which I think was a party that was at the French embassy. And it was seen in really poor taste that he went, because it was a horrible day in which 1,300 people died. I mean, if you imagine like the president of the U.S. on 9/11, if he'd just gone to a party, there would be a ton of pushback and criticism for that, and rightly so. I do think it's a little bit interesting to have his journal entry and be able to see what he really thought. And he did mention it was a great sin that's taken place, and it's horrible. The news left an ugly impression. That's the last he mentions of it in his journal entry, though. And I do think that if the public had access to his journal, they probably would still have felt the same way, maybe even more so, because after that he talks about dining and looking at the crowd at the pavilion and how there wasn't anything particular to see. He's saying this after all these people have been killed. I don't know if at that moment he knew that. But they definitely knew by the time they went to the Montebello Ball. And then he mentions they went to the Montebello Ball. It was magnificently done, but the heat was unbearable. You'd think that after something so terrible happened, he could say, well, I really felt like I had to go to this ball, and it was magnificently done, but my heart was in another place, or my mind was in another place, because there was this horrible tragedy. No, the heat was unbearable. We left after supper at 2:00. Again, this is a unique period of time because we do have journal entries or diary entries and the letters. And so this is what he is writing as his own thoughts. It's not something obviously that would go to the public. And so I think the public's reaction to him in the wake of this event was very justified, especially now reading his journal entries and knowing how he described it. The fact that he put it left an ugly impression, to me, doesn't make it seem like he was that moved by the death of all those people. And it really was, obviously, it wasn't his fault that there was a crush and that people were trampled, but they were there to celebrate his coronation. And so you just think that there would be more, not necessarily responsibility, but empathy around it. And I shouldn't say that there wasn't any, because the government did give money or food to those families. They did try to help the people who had lost family members. But I'm just saying, specifically from Nikki, I don't see a lot of empathy. So this was in 1896. The next 20 years or so, he continues to lead, and there's so many changes. And then we get into World War I. It's worth noting that he and Alex really struggled to produce a male heir. They had 4 daughters, and then finally they had their son, who had what was called the English disease, hemophilia. And he had he was bleeding from his belly button when he was born, and then he had a lot of health issues growing up. I'm sure you're familiar with Rasputin and how he would have these kind of mystical cures. And in some ways it seemed to work, but it's not clear if, okay, was Rasputin really a healer? From my perspective, most likely he was a charlatan. But Rasputin had a very calming effect on Alex. You imagine a mother who's has all this pressure on her as an empress, but also whose son, who she just loves so dearly, is sick, and he's supposed to be the heir to the throne. She was desperate, and Rasputin really came to tell her it was okay, and that her son was going to be okay. And there's multiple diary entries that talk about that as well, of kind of what she's experiencing. And it could be that sometimes when Alexei was having problems, so when her son was having problems, that actually her own like regulation of her nervous system from Rasputin, where he would help calm her, actually had a really positive effect on the son. And so it is, again, unclear. My perspective is he was a charlatan, but he did have some things that were a positive health influence on the son. But he really was a figure who tried to have more power and influence in Russia, and was using his connection to the Empress to do that. This was a real problem for Russians. They didn't like Rasputin. They didn't like the closeness that he had as far as influence, because Alexandra had a direct influence on her husband, Nikki. And she would tell Rasputin all the things that Nikki told her about state affairs, military strategies, all of that, even when he explicitly told her, don't tell Rasputin. And so he really had the king's ear and had a way of whispering to the king. One of the unique things about letter writing is that you tend to have letters when people are apart. So some of the greatest romances in history don't have letters because the people were together. And so for Nikki and Alex, most of their married life, they actually are together. I think the most interesting letters are kind of at the beginning and at the end, when they have some periods where they are separated. There are obviously their journal entries from then. So if you are interested in diving more into the relationship, there's a lot there. There's so much fascinating history about Rasputin as well, and social currents and things that were happening in Russian society. But it's worth noting that the World War I began, and Nikki decided to go to the front. As I mentioned, he was not a military man like his father, and so when he got to the front, it's almost like he wasn't of major use, because he wasn't there for strategic reasons. He didn't want to put himself actually in the line of fire, but he was out there as kind of a symbol of going to war. And from what I've learned, historians have said that shouldn't have been a problem necessarily, but he needed to leave someone or multiple people in control at home to run the affairs of the state. In going to war, he left an absence, and he was the figurehead of the, not even just the parliament, because there was parliamentary power, which he'd put into place, but it's almost like he was like the prime minister, and when he went to war, there wasn't a person to lead. And so it left a vacuum and created a lot of problems. And there are many just criticisms of him as a leader. And I think that's just kind of the nature of a monarchy, is that it's not the most qualified person who's put into power. He just got his power because of his bloodline. And so he was really ill-equipped. And especially with his father dying unexpectedly, he didn't have the nurturing to become the emperor that he needed to be, especially in such a tumultuous time. That being said, Alex made things so much worse in so many ways, because she had such influence over her husband, but she was not skilled in running the estate or warfare. And in many ways, again, she was, I wouldn't say a black mark per se, but people felt that she was too German during World War I and seen as a dangerous person. And especially when there was so much fear about German spies and all of that as well. And so she didn't help his reputation, but also she gave him a lot of advice, and it wasn't necessarily good advice. I've pulled a letter of that she wrote him when he was going to war, just to give you a sense of her tone. She loved him as deeply as he loved her. She also, though, loved him in a way that was somewhat maternal and protective, in a way that his own mother didn't love him. And so his mother did love him, but she didn't love him in that same almost coddling way that Alex did.
Here's a letter that she wrote on September 19th, 1914. "My own, my very own sweet one, looking after the wounded is my consolation, and that is why the last morning I even want to go there whilst you're receiving, so as to keep my spirits up and not break down before you. To lessen their suffering, even in a small way, helps the aching heart. Except all I go through with you and our beloved country and men, I suffer, and for my small old home and her troops and Ernie's her brother, and Irene, who's her sister, and many a friend in sorrow there, but how many go through the same? And then the shame, the humiliation to think that Germans would behave as they do. One longs to sink to the ground, but none of such conversation in this letter. I must rejoice with you that you are going, and I do, but yet I egoistically suffer horribly to be separated. We are not accustomed to it, and I do so endlessly love my very own precious Boise dear. Soon 20 years I belong to you, and what bliss it has been to your very own little wifey. How nice to see dear Olya. It will cheer her up and do you good. I shall give you a letter and things for the wounded for her. I love you as a man was rarely loved before, and kiss you and press you tenderly to my old heart, forever your very own old wifey." The little backstory I didn't give you is Boise. I don't know if you caught that in the letter. She said, "Yet egoistically, I suffer horribly to be separated. We are not accustomed to it, and I do so endlessly love my very own precious Boise dear." That is a euphemism for his penis. She called his penis Boise, and I think he called her vagina my lady or something like that. So you'll see that in their correspondence when they're separated, her talking about Boise dear. So obviously that's not a maternal aspect. There's very much a deep sexual chemistry that they have too, but this sense of, oh, I love you and I love you as no man has loved you before, and I kiss you and I press you tenderly to my old heart, there's a love that she really resources him with. And you can read many letters that she wrote while he was at war, but I feel like that one just gives you kind of a sense of her style of writing and the way that they talked with each other. Most of the letters in this podcast are between Nikki and Alex, but I wanted to highlight some things from King George V as well, who was both Nikki's cousin and Alex's cousin. Again, Alex's cousin through her grandparents, Elizabeth and Albert, and Nikki's cousin through the King of Denmark, and I'm actually forgetting his wife, but his grandparents. So his maternal grandparents and her maternal grandparents, both of them had children that married, and George V was the product of that marriage. So different sides of the family that ended up coming together multiple times, as aristocracy did. Okay, so this is King George V to Nikki, August 8th, Windsor Castle, 1915. "My dear Nikki, I feel most deeply for you in the very anxious days through which you are now passing, when your army has been compelled to retire on account of the lack of ammunition and rifles, in spite of the splendid and most gallant way our fighting against our most powerful enemy. I can assure you that in England we are now straining every nerve to produce the required ammunition and guns and also rifles, and are sending the troops of our new armies to the front as fast as we possibly can. England has made up her mind to fight this awful war out to the end. Whatever our sacrifices may be, our very existence is at stake. I'm so glad to see your letter that Russia also means to fight to the end, and I know France is in the same opinion. God bless you, my dear Nikki. Ever your devoted cousin and friend, George." It's worth noting that as the war ended and Nicholas came back, or Nikki came back to be with his family, and then he was basically brought into imprisonment or exile, that he had tried as best as he could to find passage to England. And he was going to do so to basically go stay with his cousin and maybe they'd be safe in England. But George V thought it too much a liability if there was a volatile environment in Europe where people were murdering the aristocracy, then he wouldn't want to bring that to England and give people ideas there as well. If you haven't already, you should Google a picture of Nicholas II and also George V. And there's pictures, I think, of them together. They look like twins. It's really amazing. And again, they were cousins. And so it's no coincidence that they look the way that they do. But the, it's just kind of interesting, the dynamic that maybe the Romanovs could have been saved, but then also maybe if they had been saved, that the Windsors wouldn't have been safe. So it's just kind of an interesting thought. And of course, we'll never know. I talk some about Rasputin and his unpopularity, and there is a whole Rasputin rabbit hole that you can go down. It's really fascinating. But I did want to pull a diary entry from 1916. This is one of Nikki's diary entries, December 21st. At 9 o'clock, the whole family went out past the photography building and right into the field, where we witness a sad spectacle, the coffin with the body of the unforgettable Grigory, that's Rasputin, who was killed by some scum on the night of December 17th at Yusupov's house, which had already been lowered into the grave. Father Alexander Vasilev read the liturgy, and after which we returned home. The weather was gray with 12 degrees of frost, and the afternoon went for a walk until the reports received Shakovsky and Ignatieff, and the afternoon went for a walk with the children. And there are a lot of memoirs and diary entries around Rasputin from other people. And so, again, if that's an area that you're interested in, there's a lot more that you can find as well. With Nikki and Alex reuniting, we don't have more letters from them, but we do have the diary entries. So I've just pulled a couple that are worth noting. March 23rd, this is from Nikki's diary. I looked through my books and things and started to put aside everything I want to take with me if we have to go to England. 2 days later, March 25th, the Annunciation, we spent this feast day in unbelievable conditions, under arrest in our own house, and without the slightest possibility of communicating either with Mama or our relatives. And that's in March 1917. And this is another area where if you do want to dive deeper into what that year was like, what were their living conditions like, what were they thinking about, there are the diary entries. I will say a lot of them, and maybe this was because they were probably aware that people would read their diary entries. I don't know on that. But a lot of them seem just mundane in a way. They talk about what a difficult year it has been and what does the future hold for them. And they're really struggling. But there's also a sense of, okay, well, this is what the weather was like. We spent the day indoors. Someone had a cold. Just the day-to-day life. And they were murdered by the Bolsheviks. It was a very brutal, brutal murder, which if you want to learn about that, there's a lot around that as well. And the girls had hidden all the Romanov gems in their dresses and sewn them in, which almost worked like bulletproof. And so it was like almost like bulletproof vests, which actually made the murders so much more gruesome because they were just very hard to kill through shooting. And so they were stabbed and shot and very, very violent and sad. So I won't dwell on that too much, but that was on the 17th of July in 1918. The final thing that I'll read for the episode is George V's diary entry from about a week later, the 25th of July. May and I attended a service at the Russian church in Welbeck Street in memory of dear Nikki, who I fear was shot last month by the Bolshevist. We can get no details. It was a foul murder. I was devoted to Nikki, who was the kindest of men, a thorough gentleman, loved his country and his people. I'm curious to hear what about this episode and this story interests you. Were there particular parts of their letters or diary entries that spoke to you? I think for me, again, it's the deep romantic connection that they have in Alex's hand the day after their wedding. She wrote, again, "No more separations, at last united, bound for life. And when this life is ended, we meet again in the other world to remain together for eternity." A real timeless, timeless love. But then also, as much as they were blessed with this union and their love for each other, they lacked all the things that were needed to actually survive and to thrive and to have their kin and their dynasty carry on. And so I find it very tragic. And then also, and sometimes seeing that he was so ill-equipped, I'm not saying I agree with the Bolsheviks, but that you can see why public opinion turned on them in so many ways throughout each moment of their lives. But then also realizing they just were really ill-suited for the life that they were in. But I do find their letters and their love for each other just so beautiful, particularly to read a man's letters and how loving and faithful he was to her is really beautiful as well. In the show notes, I'll include a few more resources that you might be interested in. In particular, there's a 2-episode series. I want to say it was done by the BBC, and it goes much more in depth. They do reference a lot of the same letters that I do, just because some of the best letters are ones that I wanted to mention. I did read them in a larger format in this, but they do mention some of the important correspondence. But they also provide more context around Rasputin, and they talk more about Mathilde, the woman Little K, the ballerina that he loved. So there is a lot more information about the history and the overall context, where obviously with my podcast being about letter writing, I did want to focus more on the letter writing. And I think for, you know, what we can learn, I think obviously there's tons that you could learn about the history here. But as far as what about letter writing, one of the things that I love that we have from them is the internal life and the external life. We have the letters and we have the journal entries. And so I'd say for letter writing, take time, reflect in your journal, write thoughts about what you're experiencing, and write them just for you, because that understanding of your own inner life provides so much clarity that will then affect the way that you express yourself externally as well. And also just to honor the unique moment that we're in. They lived in a very unique moment in history, and we also have our unique moment as well to fully live and to hopefully, while we're here, have that time with the people that we love and to really express that fully. The letter in which she broke up with him, even though it was a breakup letter, has that wonderful line about how she can express herself better through a letter than in person. And I still feel like that's true today, because it does take so much time to really think about how we feel in order to express it. If you like this episode, share it, review it, give it 5 stars, tell your friends, put it in your Instagram stories, tag me. Whatever is your style of love language for podcast, do it, because it's going to help it in this digital world and then in the world as a whole. I mentioned my mission is to get people writing more beautiful letters, and this podcast helps do that. So the more that you can spread the podcast and like-minded people who love letter writing and they love studying history and really looking deep into letters that people have written, I know that they'll love this, and hopefully it will help them develop their own letter writing practice as well. Thanks.